I really hope that the rest of the world that has this incredible freedom and opportunity, freedom of opportunity, actually uses it. There's the many, many people out there that don't use the time that we have as wisely as they can do. And it goes back to Kevin's message of living with intent and just not fumbling through from one day to the next. You've got to appreciate today, absolutely 100%, but you also have to realize that, you know, your hopes and dreams aren't just going to make themselves.
That is Nick Butter, and you are on the Sam Gash podcast. This is a podcast for peak performers, you know, where we host adventurers, entrepreneurs, athletes and artists, those who have ventured boldly into the unknown. They've failed, innovated, but also contributed. We skip over their highlights reel and go into the guts of who they are and what they believe in. I'm your host, Samantha Gash. I am a former corporate lawyer turned endurance athlete and social impact entrepreneur. And this podcast I am so excited to share with you. Nick Butter is the first and only person to have run a marathon in every country in the world. That's 196 countries. I reckon it's pretty easy to glamorize and romanticize this journey, particularly now that he's finished it. But it was a challenge that saw him run up to 4 marathons a week, take over 400 flights, change countries 3 times a week, and exist on barely any sleep. He's run through war zones, overcome muggings, dog attacks, and stolen luggage. He went through 9 passports, ran in 60-degree heat, pushed on through food poisoning and a kidney infection, and spent close to £1 million in the process. We deep dive and really look into why he did this, how he created it from the ground up, you know, what people need to consider if they've got excuses rolling in their mind about why they can't do the things that they really feel deeply about on the inside. We talk about the challenge in the logistics, which are immense. And we also look at where Nick is placed now through COVID-19, but also beyond. What's the things that are firing his soul through his recovery? And he's definitely someone who's always got his eye on the next thing. I truly hope you enjoy this conversation.
But I'm still quite impressed that we managed to get around, and with the support we had during the trip, it felt like by the finish line we had something crazy, like over 3 billion in reach across social media, which was just mad. And yet still people like yourself, which running crazy, and you didn't know. And I'm like, actually that's probably a good thing, because future trips that I will go on, I'm going to get even more people aware of stuff. So, and the running community is growing, right?
Oh my gosh. I think that's the one thing that has definitely been growing through, you know, COVID, yeah. Because, you know, a lot of places, the only thing that you can do to be outside is to exercise, and running is a sport that is, one, non-contact, and two, I think, mentally accessible to a lot of people, because I think they can break it up, you know, walk, run, yeah, jog, different paces. Yeah. So I think there has been a growth in the sport, which is, you know, cool for people like you and I to be able to share what we love so much with even more people.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really hoping that I'm sure, I always say that when we look back on this pandemic and the world going into kind of spiraling into some form of turmoil, when the documentaries are released in years to come and kids are learning about this moment in time, I hope that it's not just all doom and gloom and about death, and actually it's about all the positives that people have found. You know, they've reconnected with their families, they've experienced such joy in having some time available to them. And yeah, of course, you can't ignore the bad stuff, but things like sport, people getting out and riding a bike that have never done that before. And whether or not they should or shouldn't be doing that, at least it's opened them up to sport. And I've certainly seen more runners on the roads than I have ever. So I hope we remember as a species that there are positives to take from everything, because otherwise it will be a pretty grim couple of years ahead of us.
It's going to be a changing period. Like I read just the other day that, at least from an Australian perspective, there might not be overseas travel till 2023. And I think a lot of these articles that are coming out right now, really there's not a huge amount of basis for it. But you think about that and you can't help but mentally forecast what that would feel like. My first gut reaction was, oh, my gosh, like I thought I was going to be able to explore more of the world and more of my physicality and throughout the world. And I've got a thing where I very quickly go, okay, well, what's the positive out of it? And I was like, well, Australia is a pretty incredible place. There's a lot that I could spend time there. Yeah. And then I was actually speaking to a friend earlier and he's like, maybe it's not about us finding like the adventure, you know, maybe that's not what the solution is. Maybe there's some kind of other discovery that we're meant to make about ourselves during this time.
I hope that, like you say, Sam, that people will see all of this. And you know, I know people that have taken up things like pottery, and they've got stuck into art and all of that stuff, which I'm so incredibly pleased with. But hearing, you know, like you say, articles of saying you can't travel for 2023. I mean, I understand why they're kind of thinking about that and speculating about what could be, but also there is still some travel now, and I think all of us should be prepared to carry on our normal lives with a little bit more perspective, I suppose, but as soon as possible, because as soon as we, the West, sort ourselves out, there's going to be the nations out there, like places like Yemen and Sierra Leone and all those countries, which are going to need some extra help. Not just during the pandemic. And I said from the very beginning of all this that, I mean, I have quite a unique perspective just because I've come back from the world so recently, that I've seen so much suffering and so many people dying of things like starvation. You know, you have 3 million children a year under the age of 5 starving to death. And so you're like, hang on a minute, we're complaining about something that's killing us because it's affecting us. There's other stuff out there that we could be actively doing things with. And, you know, we have the antidote for that. We have food, and there's certainly enough to go around produced every day around the planet. And so I'm hoping that as a species, we learn from this, but history will say that we don't learn as much as we should.
And I think you are a perfect person to speak on a global perspective. You know, your truth is your truth. But I think it is important to get grounded by what is happening around the world, because everyone is dealing with the pandemic. It's a global one. But the severity can be far more harsh based on where you live and what is already your accessibility to things like food and clean water and health facilities as well. So whereabouts are you based right now?
We're based down in Cornwall, the deepest, darkest depths of Cornwall. We previously had a place down here. I was mid theatre tour, so as I said when I spoke with Rich, I was coming back to start a speaking tour, of which we had about 2.5-3 months complete by the time the lockdown was imposed. And that's me speaking in schools, hundreds of schools and businesses and theatres across the UK and elsewhere around the world, actually. And so as soon as that happened, we realised, right, let's just take some time and hit pause, and we will literally pick up from where we left off as soon as it is safe to do so. And so we've been down here. And like you said, Cornwall, UK, doesn't have this area, doesn't have many hospitals. And even, you know, you talk about parts of the world that doesn't have, you know, Sierra Leone has something like 150 doctors for the entire country, which is just bonkers. And we're complaining about not having enough hospitals in a county of a country that is incredibly, relatively speaking, economically well off. And so there is, like you say, everybody has their own truth and everybody can see their own moment and everything is relative. But there is a big picture out there, and I'm constantly reading stuff and I'm like, yeah, you know what, that's really not a big problem in the grand scheme of our species. And I'm sure if people could see that, then, you know, the money that's been raised recently by Captain Tom, I'm sure you've heard, I don't know if you heard about that in the UK, but really, really, really brilliant to see how much he raised for the NHS and was absolutely needed. But then on the other hand, I thought how far that would go if we'd raised that money, you know, a day before this all happened and it was for a different cause. you know, I hope that we sit up and pay a little bit more attention to it. And I've started my foundation, and lots of the stuff that I've got going on in the future, I'm going to try and do some good for the stuff that I've seen around the world, because I've certainly come back from the journey a completely different person than I was before I left. So I'm really enjoying this moment of being able to reflect a little bit, but it is a little bit busy. I've got all sorts of other stuff going on, which I don't really want to have to be doing, but the books and everything like that, I'm grateful to have them. I just want to be out running, really.
Oh my gosh. Well, you of course would see the world differently. You can't have done what you've done. And for me to give you some context, Nick, finishing in like November 10th last year, completed his epic journey to become the first person to complete a marathon in every country in the world, a venture that took 674 days, 196 countries, which means 196 marathons, although I did read that you did a couple of extra ones along the way just to give that tick of approval for the record. And like, I think of something like that no one's ever done this before. You're a 30-year-old guy, relatively new into the, you know, ultra running space in terms of like breadth of time, and even probably breadth of number of races that you've done. And I want to go back to the beginning, and I don't often in my podcast conversations like want this chronological experience, but I feel that in order to understand your understanding on the world and your lens on the world now, we need to go back to the beginning of this, because, you know, what was life for you before you even contemplated this notion of doing a challenge like this?
Yeah, so I suppose my world has been tipped upside down in many ways, but my life story in a nutshell, I suppose, is I was a kid. I was quite shy. I was dyslexic. I struggled in school a little bit, but I was actually, I think, quite bright even still. And so I tried very hard, and I have my brother who never tried very hard, but always got better grades than me. It's the classic sibling rivalry in school. And so growing up, I threw myself into sport, especially more, and did lots of running, did lots of cycling, and grew up in the middle of nowhere. And therefore, I was cycling 10 miles to school or running 10 miles to go and see my friends, because we lived so far away from anybody. And so I was like, yeah, okay, let's go. I realize in Australian terms, that's not much, but for us, that's quite far.
16 Ks. I'll give it to you, 16 K.
yeah, exactly. 16 K is still quite far. Especially when I was younger. And then after that, I got into skiing. I was in an under-19s British Snow Sports England ski team. So I was skiing for a while. I absolutely loved it and relished it. And that was my kind of dream, you know, Olympic skier, go into sport. And then very quickly, I realized that AI probably wasn't as good as I should be. And I started a little bit late, even though I was on skis from a toddler, you know. Professionally skiing is a hard game and expensive game. And then after that, I had the voice of my parents on my shoulders telling me, especially my dad, to say, look, you know, get a real job. You're going to get to a point where skiing won't earn you any money. And he was very right, because I wasn't good enough to get to that point. And so fortunately, I used what vague intelligence I had to go into finance. And I went into banking. And that is a world, as everybody knows, of more money than enjoyment, I suppose, put it that way. And it was a strange time, because I earned some money, I had some really great friends, but ultimately sport was still in my blood and I still needed to do that. And so I went out and did lots of running, I did lots of ultras. I've done now something like approaching 700 marathons and nearly 100 ultras. So I've done a fair few bits of racing, but that was kind of littered amongst a lot of work. And then I decided to stop working and kind of pursue this running career. And I did lots of mini expeditions, lots of really cool, like, kind of adventure stuff. And then I was out running in the Marathon du Sahara, MDS, the big famous 7-day race across the Sahara. And I met this guy called Kevin, and Kevin was 49 when he was diagnosed with terminal prostate cancer, a year before I met him. And he said some really powerful words to me. He said, don't wait for a diagnosis. Don't wait for something in your life to kick you up the backside to say, this is it. This is your one time on the planet to follow your dreams, to hug your family more, to go after what you enjoy the most. And he's this kind of guy that just exudes this actionable sense about him. And so I thought, you know what, this is absolutely right. And I did a bit of research about his cancer, about prostate cancer, very underfunded in the UK. And it happened to coincide with me being incredibly restless in my life. And so I thought, you know what, I am going to go and try and do something special. And then the long and the short of it was I Googled, had anybody ever done it before? And then spent the further 2 years of planning and prepping and raising funds and throwing everything I had, literally selling anything I had to be able to fund this trip. And we spent an absolute fortune. It was about £1 million. I think it's the best thing I've ever done, because I'm now come back from seeing this world in a really quick time frame, really, and running everywhere. Because I think people forget that it's not just seeing these countries. And by no means, I've not gone and explored a country for 3 years and gone around to every nook and cranny of every city in every country. I've been in and out, but I have been running 26 miles, 42 kilometers in every nation. And by that, you interact with the locals quite a lot. You experience quite a lot of different things. And all of a sudden, I come home and I'm landed in this world where everything's different. And then the world shuts down. And so it's a really, really strange time.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, you could not have been experiencing two different like realities, from being on a plane like, you know, every single day to now just living in four walls and kind of not knowing what's happening next. I guess that is one similarity, is you probably didn't really know what was going to happen next every day of those 2 years of the project. You created a plan, but you know, I can see the difference in like, you thought that you were going to do 220 flights, but it ended up being 455 flights.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's a great example of things not going to plan. But I want to backtrack, because it was so much in that then. I guess the first thing I'm going to ask, just really running rudimentary questions, did you jump straight to ultramarathons before doing marathons, or did you start in kind of more the marathon space?
I did some marathons, but then I was finishing around 3 hours in a marathon, and I was actually training when I was out going for a run, because of where I was living. There was much more time and space to run, and so I was actually running further. So I think the answer to that question is actually, yeah, I pretty much got into ultras quite quickly.
Is that because, like, what is it about kind of, I mean, even in what you did with the marathons in every country, they're far more about this expedition and adventure versus the marathon run itself. Like, is that kind of where you're wired?
Yeah, absolutely. Similar to you, Sam, I'm all about the adventure and exploring. And I use my love of running, I suppose, for a couple of reasons. One, because everybody knows that running is such a great therapy for the mind, and it's really great to get out and have that own space. But then forgetting that part of running, you have the experience of being in amazing places. And a lot of ultra events, as you know, are in beautiful parts of the world. And you get to meet also quite interesting people on the runs. And, you know, so you've got the people aspect, you've got the place aspect, you've got the peace aspect of the run. And so I definitely, you know, I'm not running for time. So often I don't run with a watch anymore. I just go out and enjoy the run. And yeah, there's an element of, you know, you need to keep a track of your fitness and making sure that, you know, when you're training for future things, you're still on top of your fitness. But other than that, I'm pretty focused at a nice balance between endurance and adventure. I see a lot of people that go off and do big adventures, big endurance stuff, sorry, and make it very, very difficult. And I'm going to more towards that. I think I need to challenge myself in the endurance aspect a little bit more in the future. But I definitely don't want to lose the adventure and being able to take my camera out and have some photos and interact with the locals, you know. There's many, many aspects to it.
I think it's worthy of saying that you're actually quite quick. So, I mean, your 5K time is, you know, 17:24. Mm-hmm. Then look at, you know, 100 miles you've done in 20 hours and 52 minutes. So you're not, I feel like you've made this discovery about your desire at a quite a young age, to be honest, particularly when there's a lot of guys in their 30s who are the type of like athleticism that you have. They're chasing down like what is the quickest 100 mile time that I can do and what is the top American 100 mile races that I can show off my fitness and finesse at. I think that experience that you had in Marathon des Sables, where you're seeing people who aren't always like the fittest people, but they're choosing to explore something else about themselves, and which is exactly what I did. I think it is profound because, you know, you came across, you know, this guy who's literally changed the course of your life. It's like you put a magnifying glass up at you going, this can happen to anyone. I'm fit. I could, you could be me. And are you happy with where you're going?
Yeah, absolutely. And I already, what was strange is that I was already talking to people about that. You know, I have friends in my finance world that I was like, why are you, you're really unhappy. You're not enjoying this life. You're not enjoying the job. Or, you know, people often moan about their life. And sometimes they either mean it or they just like to have a moan. But the people that certainly mean it and they do want to make a change, they have it in their power and it's their responsibility to make that change. And so when I had this brilliant guy, Kevin, who's 6 foot something and incredibly smiley, saying to me, you know what, you've got to do this. And he was facing only a year left of his life. You know, he was told he was only going to live for 2 years. And he's there running across the Sahara Desert with me, smiling, laughing away, talking about how life is precious. And it was utterly bizarre. And it really did leave an imprint. And we messaged really often. And even yesterday, we had a few WhatsApps backwards and forwards. And he was out on a run. And this is the most remarkable thing about the whole trip is when I met Kevin and he inspired this, I wasn't expecting to him even to be alive by the time I started the trip, let alone...
Oh, my God.
I know, exactly. And it was this trip was then going to be, you know, in memory of him, and I was going to be spurred around the world. But actually he did that himself by being alive, and we kind of had this unspoken promise to one another of, I'm going to run around the world, you stay alive until I'm back. And he is still alive now. How
is his health right now?
I mean, he's still riddled with cancer. That's the reality of it. And there's no turning back. And he kind of calls it drug roulette. He says as soon as the drug runs out, he'll get another one. And as soon as that runs out, he'll get another one. And eventually the drugs will run out and that will be that. But he's okay. He's running. He does brilliant events. He's a really good runner as well.
It must be wild for him to have kind of watched you do this. I've got to ask, had you ever contemplated like the challenge of doing a marathon in every country before Kevin told you about his circumstances?
There's a piece in the book which I talk about like a childhood conversation I had with some friends, and I distinctly remember it about discussing the prospect of, oh, wouldn't it, you know, making a list. I remember sat down with a very good friend of mine from school years and years ago. We were probably about 15, and we sat down and said, oh yeah, let's make a list of all the things we want to do another. And I was really into sport at the time, and skiing was heavily up there, and all sorts of cycling events, but I was putting things on the list that I thought I could do. And so conversations of, wouldn't it be cool to run a marathon in every country in the world, that'd be great. And you know, that's a fleeting comment that comes and goes without even thinking about it, because you don't believe it's possible, and then it's gone. And now looking back, you know, I had that inkling of a thought a long time ago, but I hadn't thought about it until I met Kevin. So yeah, it's quite magical, really.
You've got to check out a guy called Sebastian Terry. He's an Australian he's got a website called 100 Things, and super similar journey to you. You know, a friend of his actually passed away, and it was the catalyst for him writing this 100 Things list as a mechanism for him to find his happiness. And he now helps other people create their 100 things list, and he's like becomes this conduit, and it's all about acts of kindness, peer-to-peer connection. And I've got to say, like, the things on his list were like all initially, like, he was 24 at the time, like high adventure, and now it's like, how do you help people?
Which I
think that's what happens when you discover yourself. The next thing is, I've discovered who I am, and now I want to give back. I want to contribute. I want to understand humanity and what is my interplay within that whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, I'm really intrigued about this idea that it was an initial planted seed as a kid, and you just obviously didn't think much about it because it's such a far-reaching concept. What became the trigger point for you to think that it was something that's possible?
I suppose the actual answer is complete naivety.
It's the beauty, isn't it?
Yeah, if I'd known everything I know now about how difficult it was and the logistics and the stress and the finances and the problems, then I honestly think we wouldn't have even started, because it was unfair to put my family and my friends and everybody through so much. It really was. It was cruel at times, because there was so much pressure to reach the finish line. And it's, on one hand, it's romantic and lovely and this magical journey around the world. And on the other hand, you have a finish line to hit, and you're also trying to make sure you enjoy it and raise funds to do it, and also raise funds for the charity. And there's also the other elements. So I think the answer is I probably wouldn't have gone there. But the reason I decided to do it was because I'd been pushed towards this cliff of doing something big all of my life. I'd trained hard. I'd had really strict ski racer coaches. I was having this world of sport where I kind of understood the endurance and the sacrifice element. And then I was thrown into a normal life, which I didn't particularly, I suppose I did enjoy, but it wasn't my calling, I'd say. And then meeting people like Kevin, already having some running background, and just having this itch that I had to scratch. And then Kevin was like, well, do something. And I thought, you know what, I will. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think we knew how we were going to do it. I just knew I wanted to do it. And as all my family and friends will tell you, if I've made my mind up, and then my mind is made up.
Wow. I know people who do those kind of multi-stage races are people who just believe that they can create what they want, and then they kind of reverse engineer what it requires. So who at the beginning was a part of that, support team who started it kind of creating this blueprint? Who was there?
Yeah, well, for a long time, well, I suppose I had a number of weeks after the race in the desert with Kev, and didn't really think about much. I was just kind of musing on the and mulling over the concept of Kev's life, and it kind of just kept repeating with me. And so I sat down and did a few bits of Google search. It's very much on my own, kind of like laptop in bed kind of thing, just Googling stuff that people hadn't done, and let's try and do something to raise some money. I thought about seven continents. I thought about running across some countries, which I know you've done. And I thought, well, let's try and find something. Let's find something that nobody has done before. And I honestly thought that I would get to a point where I was not going to be able to raise enough money, and I needed a trip that was going to be for a long enough period, because people didn't know about me, in order to raise the awareness of me and as a personality, and then to raise it as a trip. And so that then happened. But then I suppose 4 weeks after the desert, I sat my mum and dad down in our living room, and I decided, I said, I'm going to do this. And as always,
what did they say?
They know that by the time I come to them and say that to them, that it's not just going to be a flippant comment, and that I'll have a whole initial thought in my mind of how it will work. And so they said, right, so how is that going to happen? How long is it going to take? And we went through the normal questions, and it wasn't a very long conversation. Probably about 10 minutes of just chatting through some things. And then 9 months went by of me plodding away, planning stuff full time. This wasn't just on the side anymore. This was me, lots of posted, huge map.
So I did. You left your job in finance by now.
Yes. Yeah. 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 Jeez. Yeah. Yeah.
And no side hustle job. Like literally, like I'm putting this together.
Yeah.
That's absolutely my job.
Yeah.
Got it. That's, I love it, because I think it's hard to keep one foot in the camp and the other going in the water. And making these things happen. And I did that, in my very early years of kind of exploring the adventurous side of me. And I was a lawyer, and I just remember recognizing that I was spending more and more of my law hours creating my adventures. And it got to a point where I was like, this is not fair on anyone right now. I need to like take the jump. But even myself, like I then went and worked in a finance boutique firm, and then in communication. So I definitely respect the ballsiness that comes from going, I'm just leaving it all. I'm not going to be earning an income. I'm investing 100% into this.
Yeah, and I was in a really lucky position with my boss at the time, and he is a very good friend of mine still, a guy called Razzy, an absolute brilliant man. And he understands, and he's probably, I think any of the great bosses in the world, no matter what industry you work in, are the people that understand that life comes before work. And I think sometimes bosses can get bogged down with kind of controlling the people that work for them in a work element and forgetting that they're actually human beings. And what Razzy did was really understand what I needed and wanted, and actively encouraged me to not shut the door and to say, look, do this. And if you ever want to be back, and he knew full well that there would be no chance. But didn't say, you know what, if you leave, then goodbye. I was very, very fortunate to be in that position, because I think a lot of other people are better runners than me, better at planning, better in pretty much every way. But if they don't have that support in just one of the angles, like that I had the support, then maybe that dream will never happen. And so it's a big network of people that make things happen like this. It's not just the big sponsors. It's not just my parents. It's not just the teachers that help me learn to read. It's not just my ski coaches. It literally comes down to everybody in the whole chain. And you know it as well as anybody, that you have to have great people around you.
Yeah, but I think you discredit your own ability to have created that chain. And yes, you've got incredible people in your life, and your parents' support, you know, logistically and financially, awesome. Yeah. And it was nice that your boss said that. But the reality is, even if you can't go back to that exact job, you can go back to another job in finance. So if you quit a job, you've got to know that, you know, you can always return to that space. And I think, you know, you're very humble about your abilities, but I think you took, as you said, you jumped off that cliff and you were willing to see how it panned out. And it sounds like you were very resolute in making it work out.
Yeah, I was. And like you say, I'm when I'm speaking businesses and schools especially, I'm a big advocate of sharing this whole message that we're talking about now, which is about, you know, if you don't have everything aligned, then you can still go and do all this stuff. But you have got to have the bravery. And especially for kids, they're kind of this blank canvas, and they've got the rest of they don't know it, but they've got the rest of this magical world ahead of them. And so do we. And so I have to keep reminding myself of that, and that I am now effectively a toddler compared to a 98-year-old. And so I've got this rest of this amazing life, and it's a blank canvas. And so I'm spreading that message and trying not to have the preconceptions that I had before, not just about the world, but about being able to do this kind of stuff. So, yeah, I did take a leap. And I tell you what, Sam, is the best leap I've taken ever.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people use the finance excuse. I mean, I think people very easily find an excuse for why they can't make, you know, the adventure that's kind of circling in their mind happen. What's your response to people when they say, I don't have that type of money, no one in my family network has that type of money, I'm not connected to those type of people on a friendship level, and I haven't done enough yet to gain any type of sponsor that will financially back me? What's your response to that?
Well, I think there's a misconception that I had all of that, and I certainly didn't. And yes, maybe I had more than others, especially a great network, and lots of very fortunate people, very, very great people around me that I was fortunate for. I suppose my response is that you have to start somewhere, and you have to create that momentum. You know, you have to get to the point where you have built the snowball and it's about to then tumble itself and build and get bigger. There's no way that you can ever achieve anything by making excuses for not doing it. And the only way is to go, right, well, I don't know this. It's the same with everything. You know, I play the piano a bit, and I've never really learned it properly, but I have a little practice every now and then when I can get to a piano. And I don't want to be a big concert pianist, but I'll sit down and I'll have a little go, and I'll do some YouTube videos or whatever, and I'll get better. And I think that's the main thing. It's like, no matter what you want to do, you have to start, and you have to take responsibility for that. Because if you want to achieve something, then other people aren't going to achieve it for you. And yes, they might be enablers, and you might be able to build that support up. But I tell you what, if I was in that position where I didn't know where to start with the planning, for example, and so I got online and Googled a few people that have done really cool stuff, and I spoke to them, and now some of them are really great friends of mine. some of them are mentors of mine that have helped me through this whole journey of being able to not only make it this adventure, but understanding how things will happen afterwards, you know. And so things like the media and with writing the book and all of that sort of stuff comes from having conversations. And another thing I talk to especially adults about is having a conversation with people that you don't know. And so things like sitting on the train or sitting on the bus or a plane and you're sitting next to somebody you don't know. I can't tell you, Sam, how many people I've met that are now in my really close circle of brilliant people and very well connected, and I've just been random people that I've happened to say hello to on a plane or on a bus or years ago, and they all kind of work out. I don't know if you know the story between my current assistant that works for me, a guy called Veton. I met him when I was running the Silverstone Half Marathon in the UK about 5 or 6 years ago now. And he's this brilliant guy called Veton. He's from Kosovo, and we finished the run. We were sheltering in a hangar when it was raining. And we just had a 5-minute chat. And I learned from that chat his name and that he was from Kosovo and that he was a nice guy and said, if you're ever in Kosovo, then hit me up, come and stay with me, whatever. And at that time, I had no idea that any of this was going to happen. But we kept in contact. I had his details. He had my details. But we didn't actually speak for about 3 years. And then the day I turned up in Kosovo, he was there waiting for me at the airport and I had no idea about it.
No way.
I know. And then skip ahead another 6 months. And I learned that he not only was a brilliant person and a great runner, but he also used to work for the UN. And he had a lot of great friends with the UN and has since managed to orchestrate, countless entries and exits to countries all over the world. And then, of course, I hired him to be my assistant and we've never looked back since. And so that's just from a 5-minute conversation in a hangar in the rain in Silverstone. And so to answer your question, I suppose more directly, is that you communicate with what you have, you work with what you have, and you believe in it and you don't give up until you achieve it.
Oh, that's so, gives me like chills. I'm loving it. I'm also in like Melbourne cold weather right now, but I love this idea of, just sharing what you feel with someone that you are not expecting anything from.
Yeah.
And I think you often receive so much more when there isn't an expectation from the other person as well. That said, I also believe there's power in asking. And you have to be willing to ask what you want, but also comfortable that they will say no. And that's their choice also.
Yeah, that's so true. That's so true. And I learned that in an extra way, because I think I've pretty much already had that nailed. I understood that before the trip. But when I went away and I was asking to take photos of people in these different countries, because for the photo book and just for my own, scrapbook, if you like. And the amount of times you go up and say, oh, can I take a photo? And you'd get a response of, oh, amazing, yes, please, please, please. And they'd want to see the photos and they'd want a copy of the photo, everything possible, whether it's an adult or a kid or whether you're in Nepal or whether you're in Australia, it doesn't really matter. And then sometimes you'd get a no. And so it was like, oh, yeah, okay, there's definitely always two sides of that coin. So I've experienced that quite profoundly of the, you've got to ask and accept the yes and the no.
Yeah. Oh, well, let's go to still to logistics because, I've done, now what I feel like I've done is such on a small scale level, but I felt the logistics when I ran across India immense and challenging. And then when I get there and nothing goes to plan as well. So what's it like trying to get permits to go into all these countries, and which countries did you find the most challenged to get to?
Which ones did we not? There were so many countries which were difficult. I suppose Iran was quite difficult, Yemen, Syria, Libya, any of the places which are obviously politically a little bit volatile and unstable. But war zones aside, there's still a lot of paperwork for other places, things like the Kingdom of Bhutan, and even access to places like Tuvalu or Nauru, some of the tiny Pacific islands. And so a lot of that had to be orchestrated. And we still didn't get it right. We managed to finish this trip, but looking back, there was a lot of lucky moments and there was a lot of unfortunate moments that we tried to overcome, but we still didn't quite overcome them as well as we should have. So things like, when I arrived in the Congo, the Republic of Congo, my visa was was a few days out of date. And I was detained for a while. And when you're in the Congo as well on your own, you do experience kind of quite fear at that point, because you don't know whether you're going to be locked up or not. But then you also have the back of your mind, you still have to make sure you've got all of the other visas aligned. We used a company in London called Universal Visas who volunteered to support with the journey and wrote off all of their additional. Absolutely. But it took, that's exactly the point. I suppose, where did we start with that? I had about those first 9 months of planning. I totted up everything that was going to cost for the visas, and it was just such a huge sum that we thought, well, this is just a ridiculous waste of money, and I can't really quantify, I can't really justify doing that. And then we managed to find this brilliant company with a kind of a small business with some lovely people that were really well-meaning, and they said, yeah, we'll do it. We'll help you get all of these.
Do you think there was naivety on there?
Yes, a little bit, but also they definitely knew what they were doing all the way along. Definitely, I think naivety, not for the visas, but for the duration. You know, I was naive in the sense that when I built my team at the beginning of the trip, to have various people coming along, I was naive to the fact that it was a 2-year journey and people's lives would evolve. People had babies, people got married, people emigrated, you know, the amount of stuff that happens in a 2-year period. And so these guys, you know, they had various different turnovers of staff, and yet they still managed to help us. So to answer your question, a lot of the war zones were trouble, but there were plenty of other ones which we just happened to not get quite right.
Was it you who worked out the sequence, or did Universal Visas kind of give you a heads up that, hey, if you go to country X and Y, that's going to affect you getting into, you know, Pakistan later on?
Yeah, exactly. It was a big joint effort. We did most of the work through a travel agent right at the very beginning. I went in and said, you know, make me a nice big list and then give me a discount on all these flights, and maybe we can do it with you. And they made the list, which turned out to be almost impossible, and we ended up changing it quite a lot. But we started from scratch, and then they built upon it, and then they didn't give us any discount for the flights. And so we thought, well, I'm going to every country in the world, I want some discount. And then we worked out that if we book all of the flights ourselves, it was gonna like basically halve the cost. And so then my dad stepped up, and he was the one that took that on. So
your dad did all kind of like your flight logistics, right?
Yeah, he did. He's not just a pilot. I'm a very, very lucky guy. I know.
He's a lucky boy. I hope you're giving him a lot of love now.
he joked. We always joke that for the next thing I want to do, he's not going to have any involvement in the logistics, because in all honesty, it was completely unfair of him to, because it was very, very stressful towards the end of making things, because it wasn't just the flights. It was even, I just challenge anybody to try and link up just the 14 Pacific Islands in a way that are quick and you can do them within 2 or 3 weeks. It's just nearly impossible. And so just little things like that are quite stressful. But so once we had the original route, we then sat down with Universal Visas and the family and friends and various team members and tried to get it right. But even when we left, we had about 20 countries that we still didn't know how we were going to get to and when. So, yeah.
So did you kind of just start the journey with a degree of uncertainty, but there were people behind the scenes still trying to move those applications forward?
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely feels... I was just the tip of the iceberg doing the running, and everybody else back in the UK or all over the world were helping with various different things. And, you know, passports were being sent around the world, and I had people and family and friends coming out to deliver a passport to me and all sorts of stuff.
Were you feeling the burden of, I guess, a few things? Firstly, the uncertainty of it. And were you also feeling the burden of, you know, very important people in your life kind of pulling this all together behind the scenes?
Yes, I didn't initially. I think, and I've touched on this, I suppose, a few times in various different chats, I think the selfish aspect of my personality put that aside quite a lot, and it's not, I'm not proud to admit it, but I think that in order to do this, I had to have some form of selfishness in me. Because I was putting everybody that I loved and cared about in stressful positions. And I didn't really acknowledge that for a good year of the journey. obviously it was there in the background, but then it really started to hit home when I realized everything that was going on and the countless amount of hours and, you know, phone calls at 2 o'clock in the morning, and then they were already up, you know, working on some other problem that we had that I didn't know about. And they shielded me from so much at the beginning that I didn't fully appreciate that. And I was stupidly selfish, and I'm not proud of it, but that it happened. And then at the end, the curve of the burden just was incredibly steep, incredibly steep. The amount of phone calls we were having, I suppose, in the last 3 weeks of the journey, probably quadrupled, because there were so many problems going on that we needed to hit that finish line on November 10th in Athens. And we still didn't have visas, we didn't have access. And I was putting everybody through that burden. There was lots of tears and tantrums and conversations saying, we can't do this. You know, having those phone calls with, especially when my dad called me a few countries from the end and he said, you know what, son, we can't do this. We don't have the money, we don't have the time, and we don't have the visas or the access. And, you know, when you've done 190 odd countries and you've only got four or five left, that's not what you want to hear.
Which countries were these?
So the most difficult, the problem countries that we had towards the end, the big one was Iran and the other was Yemen and Syria. One of the horrendous moments we had in Syria was the day before I was due to take my overland journey. So my travel wasn't always by plane, because there sometimes aren't airports or aren't flights. And so I was traveling overland from Beirut, Lebanon, through into Syria. And I'd just come from Yemen, having done that one, and I had the phone call from him saying that the driver and everything that we had arranged to take you over that, I suppose it's about 100 kilometers of journey. And he said that that driver was very sadly shot and killed the day before he was due to take me on that very road. And he was killed on that road. We had to make a decision of, do we carry on? Do we find another driver, get to the bottom of what happened and all of that sort of stuff. So it was incredibly, I mean, that's just one example of many. And we'd be here all week going through all of the different iterations of things like you arrive in an airport and you'll know that you need to be able to communicate with your team. And so you wait until you've got your bag and you've got your phone out, and then you find a SIM card or you find Wi-Fi somewhere, and that takes time. And then all of these minutes are ticking by, and it's moments that you can't waste. And I also don't have anybody else to bounce ideas off. You know, when you're on your own, you have to kind of think for yourself.
So you've got no one, I guess, doing the journey with you in any you might have people on the ground, but there's not someone who's kind of doing the transport with you, connecting the pieces.
No, not at all. Just me. And even when I had friends and family and other loved ones come and see me every so often. You know, for example, I had a mate of mine called Danny who, he took a month out of work and he came and did some of Europe with me, and we did lots of we used the train network, the Interrail network. But even so, he was coming into my world and I was very much used to it. And so he was just doing what I was saying. and because I was like, yeah, we need to get here. And it was a bit of an awakening for him, because he didn't realize, you know, looking at it from Instagram just appears to be nice, pretty, pretty places and a marathon. But the bits in between of, you know, we got on so many wrong trains, but you just have to get it right eventually. And yeah, it was a hell of a bosh job, all things considered. But I'm pleased it was like that.
I mean, I can't even imagine what the conversations that you had, particularly with your father and your mum.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're making that decision in Syria to proceed ahead and get another driver to go into a really an area of conflict with a lot of, you know, violence and unpredictability, like what are you saying to them, like when you're like, yep, we're going ahead, we're proceeding?
I think that was there was a bit of a pause on the line when I spoke with them at that point, and they said, well, it's up to you. You know, the option we had was any of these problem countries that were causing so much trouble, was we could do them after we finish in Athens. But that wouldn't have been the finish. And having spent all of our money and 2 years of my life doing this, you know what it would feel like to cross that finish line. If you'd run across India and you get there and you have a big celebration and you say, well, actually, I've got another 200 kilometres to run, it wouldn't quite feel the same, would it?
I can definitely relate. But now becoming a mother, I can also see the other side of like the care and nurture from your parents going. I can imagine your parents going like, I don't give a fuck about the run. Like, to be perfectly honest, they'd be like, I care about you. You're my son. And it's almost like this project became the thing. It became the record, became the entirety of who you were, and finishing at all costs was the critical feature.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you're absolutely right. Finishing at all costs. And, you know, we had conversations about, well, if we can't get visas to certain countries, are we going to try and risk doing it illegally? And all of these conversations. And in all honesty, you know, had I been in that position where we couldn't have had access to countries, then I think I don't know the honest answer, because you never know unless you're in the position, but I believe I would have just gone ahead and done whatever it could have done, as long as I wasn't hurting anybody else, to get to that finish line. And so the immediate answer was for me, well, yeah, we have to find another driver to take me across that border. And that was a similar conversation in many, many countries, you know, Iran being one of them. We were refused entry to Iran 3 times. And on the third time, we decided that, right, it was either we do something illegally or we find a loophole in the mechanism to allow us to get there and back. And I've known people that have done loads of stuff in Iran and not had any problem, and yet I was experiencing loads of problems. So
you would have had to have a stack of cash on you for fixing and bribes and for who knows what. I mean, like, yeah, we I have, mean, I can't believe you had no one with you to... You had a lot on your plate. I'm actually trying to get my head around it, because, I mean, the running was nothing. I mean, I'm sure it was painful at times, but really it was probably nothing.
You've hit the nail on the head, Sam. Absolutely. The running was nothing in comparison. Absolutely. You know, the running was the piece. The running was the enjoyable bit. It was, oh, finally, I'll go for a run. And don't get me wrong, you know, I had food poisoning. I was ill. I had kidney infections. I was peeing blood sometimes. Some of the runs were horrendous because of the quick succession and the fact that I was in places where I didn't have any food or water. Classic example being Iran. I finally got to Iran, a place called Kish Island, and I was permitted 12 hours in the country, and it was at night as well, and I had this driver who didn't speak very good English, and I often hired a driver who would drive behind me in case there was any problem. But I needed him for this one specifically because there wasn't any water stations. And I said, right, let's go. Checked that he had the water with him, and he didn't. And he said, don't worry, we're going to get it from a garage around the corner. And that garage around the corner didn't come for 24 miles. And so, you know, when you're at 38 or 37 kilometers, whatever that is, and you haven't had a drink of water in humid 40 degree Iran after you've done 192 marathons, it hurts. So you're absolutely right. Yeah. Running, in contrast to everything else, was absolutely nothing. The struggles with the juggling with the bribes. I paid 60, 70 bribes, something like that. I can't remember how many exactly. Ranging from $10 to thousands of dollars. And I'd always have to have numerous amounts of different currencies and cash on me. You know, I bearing in mind that people just assume that countries exist with a network and an infrastructure and ATMs and an exchange, and obviously that's not the case all over the world. And even some countries that I was in, they have such bad situations with their currency crisis that they don't have money in cash machines, and the only money that's being accepted is a foreign currency because their currency is so up the pan. So
there a time when you were like absolutely, absolutely stranded, either financially or on a health-wise or a safety-wise?
A few times. I suppose that's an understatement. More than a few times. I've had places where I turned up to an airport, dropped off, abandoned, had no money whatsoever. You know, I hitchhiked to the airport, get to the airport, and then the airport is closed. and I have no way back to find my way to the next place. And I don't speak the language and all that sort of stuff. And so that happened a few times, the currency being one. The main problem is always safety. You know, I can deal with not having money, but the safety element of being in places where I was mugged and attacked a few times. I was hit by a car a couple of times. And when that kind of stuff happens, you definitely immediately feel like I'm sure you've had in moments where you all of a sudden wake up and feel like you're really on your own because you have to deal with the situation. You can't just call the emergency services, or you can't just call home because you've not got your phone or it's out of battery. Or, you know, there's times when I've turned to my sat phone because I'm like, right, I'm being hounded by these people at the airport to take me to a place in an African country. I don't remember where I was. And they say to me, oh yeah, we'll take you, we'll take you. And it feels very unsafe. And I'm getting these, you know, I've traveled many countries already, and I'm thinking, you know what, this isn't right. And so I get my sat phone out to call home and just check I haven't got a driver on hand or somebody's not there waiting for me to pick them up. And there was nothing in my diary. My phone battery had very little. And I just get my sat phone out and it doesn't work. And you think, well, what do I do now? When you just have to kind of make it up and hope for the best and, you know, pick the taxi driver that is actually going to get you where you need to get to. And countless times I've paid people it's like old shoes and stuff.
I mean, I know that your commitment's unwavering and you're obviously very resolute to finish this, but was there ever a point when you're like, this is too much? Like, if this is too much for me, like, let alone like it's too much for everyone else, did you ever feel like I can't do this anymore?
I think the answer to that question is physically and mentally, independently, just me and myself, no. You know, I woke up on that morning in Bangladesh where I had horrendous food poisoning. I was throwing up every single mile. And my same response was, this is part of the journey. You know, this is part of the journey. This is what I signed up for. When I was mugged in Nigeria and had a knife to my throat and all that sort of stuff, you then think, am I risking too much? But then you get back and you have a shower and you sort yourself out and you realize that, no, this is part of the journey. You carry on. And before you know it, you get to the finish line. And so I didn't have any of those horrendous, I need to stop. The only really real reasons I wanted to stop sometimes was because of the other elements of the journey. Things like missing funerals, missing weddings, missing babies, my family being under horrendous stress, and getting to the point where we still, at no point until we crossed the finish line, did we know we were going to cross the finish line. And so there was that for others, you know, increasingly so as the trip went on, I was more and more concerned about the other stressful people. And I suppose I realized that as we got close to the finish. But the answer is no, not in myself, but sometimes for others.
Has it had a negative impact long-term for many of your relationships?
No, really fortunate, really, really fortunate that my friends, bless them, every now and then I would WhatsApp them if I was in a country that had any Wi-Fi, or, you know, many countries, some of them don't allow WhatsApp messages. And so whenever I'm in a place where I could message them, I would frantically say hello to everybody. And, you know, I have some great friends that I went to school with that I haven't, you know, we don't speak every day, but we'll be relying on each other at any possible moment if we really needed it. And so every now and then I'd get a lovely message. And a classic example of this kind of community spirit, and I always said if I could sum up this whole journey in one word, it wouldn't be anything to do with running or travel, it would be everything to do with people. The people I met on the journey, the people that were behind me, the people that were my kids, that were my, as a kid, sorry, as a kid from my family and friends network, from my old school teachers to my boss, everybody made the whole journey bearable, possible and brilliant. I'm very, very, very grateful for that. You know, I've got friends that I'm still, we don't speak to each other for a year, and I say, oh, hello, mate. And he goes, yeah, right, I've been following what you're doing. And that's how we are sometimes. And so they appreciate that. They know that, you know, I had a phone call the other day with about 10 or 20 people of my kind of my close network of friends and kind of fixers in these kind of expeditions, as I'm sure you do when you're planning your next thing. And I sat them all down and said, right, this is what I'm going to do. And absolutely none of them were impressed or raised an eyebrow. They were like, right, what do we need to do?
You've got good people in your life.
Yeah, exactly. And that's it. And that's in my eyes, if you're enjoying yourself, you're waking up happy, you're not hurting anybody, and you've got these people around you, then life's not too bad.
I feel like you must have shown something, you know, from being a kid to even, you know, your teens, early 20s, you must have shown something to the people in your life that when you say something, you're going to follow it through. Because the fact that they all came on board, it's almost like there was an acceptance from them that he's going to do this, and we either are a part of this and share it with him, or he's going to be on his own doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I honestly don't know. I definitely think now especially after finishing this mission, I think I will take the title of being able to finish this stuff. But there's been cases where I think from an ultra running perspective, as you'll know, there's plenty of times when you have to dig deep and you go through those dark miles in your mind and you get to the finish, and you know, family and friends that don't really appreciate running as much as we do, maybe they'll be really impressed by that. And maybe that is to be impressed with. But there's also times when I've, you know, the one specific thing where I was trying to run through Ireland, I know you're friends with Mimi. Mimi and I have met a couple of times, and I'm a big fan of Mimi Anderson, and she has the Irish record running north to south of Ireland, Malin to Mizzen. And I attempted that several years ago, and I got pneumonia halfway through, pretty bad pneumonia. And it was my one big thing. I did lots of mini things like this before this trip, and I tried to do this, and it was my first time where I was properly failing at something because of me and just me. You know, it wasn't anything else that happened. It was my body let me down, and that was because I let my body down because I hadn't prepared enough, and it was raining and I was cold and I got pneumonia and I couldn't breathe properly and I had to stop. There was no way that I could have finished. And I had to really, really deal with that. And so I think having those failures and having those things where you don't succeed are also very, 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 very valuable. And I certainly thought about that a few times when I was away.
So yeah, did that kind of lay the foundation for how you prepared in those 2 years in the physical and mental side of things, let alone all the, you know, logistics we've chatted about, but you know, mentally, physically, what were you doing in the 2 years beforehand?
Yeah, I mean, physically wise, I was running my usual mileage. I knew that doing 3 marathons a week every week for nearly 100 weeks was not going to be easy, but it was more the doing things. You know, you can't just go out and train to run a marathon on the flat surface in the British weather having had a lovely breakfast. You have to go and run having had no food, no sleep, running in really hot climates. And so I tried to do a bit of that, but if I'm honest, my training, it wasn't the training element, it wasn't the physical side. It was the mental side that I knew that there was going to be a bit of an onslaught of having to deal with things. And you know, when you're tired and frustrated, and the biggest problem I had overall on the trip was just coming up for air and wanting to hit pause and go, just give me a day just to feel a bit better, or just to give me 5 hours to have extra sleep, or you know. And so I don't really know how I could have prepared for that. The funny thing was when I did my first marathon of the journey, which was in Canada, Toronto, it was minus 25 degrees C, so super, super cold, 10 degrees colder than I was expecting it to be. And I realized during that run with these brilliant people that I'd never met come out and run with me for the first one, and we since then had many, many more people joining. And I realized that I hadn't actually done more than a half marathon distance for about 3 or 4 months beforehand. And the reason being is I'd broke my ankle in the October before, and I'd since just not gone and trained. I was just resting it as much as I could. And before I knew it, I got bogged down in all of the planning, and oh dear, I'm running in Toronto and I have another 195 to do. So I suppose the answer is I didn't. Go on.
God, what's got, I can't believe it. Like, you spend like two, you know, just sub of 2 years prepping for something, you get a broken ankle. Oh my God. I mean, what are you thinking in your head at that time?
I know. I couldn't believe it when people saw me with my, you know, hobbling around. They couldn't believe that was happening to me. I think my mindset was still so focused on all of the logistics and everything else. It was really, it's kind of, I don't know whether the phrase is chicken or egg or another analogy, but because I was so focused in the planning, my body, my physical side was just resting, and I'd kind of forgotten about that because I knew I had the mental strength to suffer through a few marathons if I had to get my fitness back up. And so I was like, just deal with the leg being out of action and then just concentrate full on into planning. I didn't really realize that it was going to take me all the way through to when I left to get better. But had I not had all of that planning, then maybe I would have done myself more damage by going out and doing training. So I don't know.
I mean, there was no need for you to be in peak physical form before you started this thing. Like, it was probably better if you had a little bit of weight on, you know, a bit loose, and then to kind of, you're going to fine tune pretty much by the third week.
Yep, absolutely. Yep, and I think I kept fine tuning until the end, and I'm still not quite there yet.
Why did you have the, like, was it a bit of an arbitrary goal to do it in the time frame that you did?
Well, two big factors, I suppose. Number one is the cost. If you add, so if I added an extra day to every country, that's an extra 9 months, which is a long period of time. And when we were spending close to, you know, several thousands of pounds every week, we were like, you know what, we can't really afford to do that. And also there was the record element of, I could go and do this over a 5-year period and it'd be an incredible epic voyage. But there was also a side of, I wanted it to be grueling enough. But like I said earlier, I have the endurance grueling balance. And I think we got that quite right, because the grueling element came from everything else and the running just didn't help that. If I had my options to do it all over again, I wouldn't change it and do it quicker or slower. Because I think we got that quite right. I mean, I would like to have another decade of being able to prep, but other than that, I think we did it about right. And, you know, taking a number of the records of the fastest man to visit every country in the world and all that sort of stuff, it's nice to have those ones as well. But as I went around the world, that very quickly became insignificant to me, and I was just looking forward to the next group of kids that I was going to, you know, get a randomly come along and run alongside with me. So I know you've experienced
kids
that.
Are so they're so cool. I mean, this makes me think about, you know, I guess a couple of things. The first thing is, like, what's your relationship with records now? I've always, on a personal level, I'm not really into the records. I think, you know, when you do a record, particularly when you're connecting it with a social impact objective. Yes. The media wants to talk about is the record, and it's really hard to funnel their attention into what you think is the why. So I've kind of gone, I'm not going to do a record because I'm just going to go, it's an arbitrary route. It's so random that really, of course, no one else has gone this way before. But for you, you're obviously doing it to raise, you know, significant amount of money as well, and you wanted to do the record. So where do you sit with that?
Yeah, you're right. I think the record, as the journey progressed, the record was less and less important. But at the same time, I knew, as much as when you sit on a sofa and have an interview with a big media station, they want to know all of the nitty gritty that we're talking about now. But they also do occasionally say to me, you know what? And I think, as you know, Sam, I just ignore the question and then talk straight out, talk exactly. If there's a call I'm talking about, I'll just talk about it. And so I think there's an element to that. In terms of records, the only reason I like records now is because they shine a light and people sit up and pay attention. If you're doing something, I'm more interested in doing something for the first time as opposed to beating something. Yeah. But then there's also things that I've got, you know, that I've got in the back of my mind that I want to do in future that are testing my endurance and also testing my adventure. And if I can raise the money, and we've got some stuff planned to do with some volunteering stuff, which I'm really looking forward to initiating. And that will involve some records. And it's a really difficult question to answer. You know, my relationship with records is I'm frustrated with having to go through all of the bureaucratic stuff with submitting stuff. I don't do these trips for records. I never will. I'm doing them. If they're records and they happen to coincide with what I want to do, then perfect. And then that means we can use them to our positives in the media. You know, because people will do great things out there, but if the light isn't shining as brightly as it could do, then I'm missing an opportunity. So, you know, being able to say I'm the first person to run a marathon in every country in the world, that feels nice because nobody's ever done it and nobody had the ways or means or the guts to do it. And I have dreamt it, was completely and utterly naive, and then went out and fortunately did it. And so that feels quite good. But no, all of my future stuff is going to be based around that happy balance between endurance and adventure, and if it happens to coincide with something that we can use as a headline catching record, then so be it.
Yeah, I like that for you. And I would also say, like, I reckon you can still get the catchy headline without the record, even though I know it's like, it's nice to package something up really neatly and tidy for the media, but you can't, you've now got the platform. You have to trust in what you've created now off the back of, you know, you'll always be able to say this, you will always be the first person to do a marathon in every country in the world, and no one can ever take that from you.
Yeah.
Now the thing is, where do you use that? And you can choose like that entire direction. And you can leverage from the credibility that you've created from this thing. So I just would, you know, encourage you to not feel that you need a record. And I will also say that some of the adventure community can be highly critical when you're doing records, and it almost takes away from like this beauty of adventure and the connection of humanity and observation, which I feel when I'm listening to you, that's what you're actually really driven by now.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. That is a very, very good point. And you are right. There's always more negative eyes looking at you if you're doing records and things like that. You've said it completely aptly, correctly, that I'm, you know, the future stuff that I'm going to be doing is about the adventure side. And I hope that, like you say, that the record element doesn't matter. There's so many, you know, you talk about that list of 100 things. I've got so many things I want to do.
When you finished it, did you feel this sense of I need to rest now, or was there a sense of urgency in you to keep momentum going in whatever you think momentum really means now?
Good question. I think I did have some time where I wanted to relax, but in all honesty, I don't think that's happened. I think the lockdown has been the first time that's happened. And I've been definitely reflecting, and I've been at more at peace with myself than I have been in the last decade, I would suppose, just during this period, because I've actually had time to think about my trip and just be grateful for it in different ways. And I've been talking about it so often in theatres, in schools, in businesses, interviews, that I'm talking about it, but I'm not really thinking about it, if that makes sense. And so I've had a little bit of time late to think about it and soak it in. The answer is I haven't rested. I haven't had that rest.
Only finished in November. Like, you, let's get some month perspective. You finished in November. We're in May right now, so that's, you know, 6 months. That's like a drop. It's literally a drop in the ocean. I imagine your mind is still in overdrive. Like, is there times when you kind of wake up and you feel like you've got to be in another place?
I did have that for, I suppose, the first couple of months I was back. And I didn't actually adjust very well to being in one place. it was really strange, but being in one place all the time just felt incredibly slow. And it just didn't feel right, and I didn't feel comfortable with it. You know, waking up in a random hotel room or somebody's house that's hosted me in a country and not knowing where anything is, that was homely. Airports were homely. And now it really was strange, you know, because 2 years is a long time, and you definitely create habits in that time, which I've now had to recreate. But living in a van is definitely a good bridge between coming back and living in a house.
Yes, I do love that you're in the van life. Are you in the van life during ISO?
Yeah. Love it. I wouldn't have it any other way. I'm definitely realizing you don't need lots of things and gadgets. As long as I've got an internet connection to be able to speak to people all over the world and all that sort of stuff, I'm happy. And I don't think, never say never, but I don't think I'll ever really go back to conventional living. You know, how Rich lives now is incredible in his containers and his tent. I think I will probably go more down those lines, and I have lots of hopes and dreams to build like lots of cabins in the middle of nowhere and all that sort of stuff. So I think conventional home living and normal bills and all that sort of stuff I'll probably never have again. Never say never, though.
Yeah, never say never, but I'm excited about you because you have, you know, because it's a record, no one's ever done it, your insights, no one has this. Like, no one knows what this is like, one, to have pulled it off, but to also to have experienced it. And I I would be loath to not ask you the question of, on a humanity perspective, like as you're traveling through all these countries with diversity of people and land and geography and language, you know, what are some of the takeaways that you found?
Yeah. So many takeaways. The people being the headline. The people will always have their headline, and there's this direct, incredibly strong correlation between people that don't have and people that give. And so the countless times when I was needing some water or needing a place to stay or directions or a smile even, and most of the time the rest of the world, and I say most of the rest of the world because it is most of the rest of the world, don't have as much as we have. Anybody that is listening to a podcast is up there in the top couple of percent of the world that is incredible. 100%. Exactly. And so experiencing that is one thing. And it also made me feel almost unworthy. You know, I'm gallivanting around the world, running marathons. You know, less than 1% of the world has ever run a marathon, and less than 1% of the world have ever left their own country. And I was doing both in quick succession over 2 years, going everywhere. And it made me feel quite, it almost made me feel like I was obnoxious and like I shouldn't be doing this. And I wasn't worthy because so many people needed more than for me to go and have fun around the world. And I did struggle with that during the middle of the trip quite a lot, especially in the African legs. Just seeing so much diversity and poverty and need. You know, when you go into I have a friend who worked in a hospital in Freetown in Sierra Leone, and experiencing so much horrible deaths of young kids for absolutely no reason other than the fact that they didn't have some money for malaria meds, or they didn't have any knowledge of sanitation, or, you know, and so I learned a lot about poverty. People and poverty were my real takeaways from the whole journey. And the other aspect of it is that I really hope that the rest of the world that has this incredible freedom and opportunity, freedom of opportunity, actually uses it. There's many, many people out there that don't use the time that we have as wisely as they can do. And it goes back to Kevin's message of living with intent and just not fumbling through from one day to the next. You've got to appreciate today, absolutely 100%. But you also have to realize that, you know, your hopes and dreams aren't just going to make themselves. And we only get one life. And so by the time I get to my deathbed, I'd like to look back and go, you know what? Yeah, I was appreciating everything. I was grateful for everything. And I was cramming everything as full as I could. And I think my outlook on that will change and adapt once I have children. And I'm sure you're in that stage. And I'm looking forward to that kind of, I don't know what the word is, but a change, I suppose. But at the moment, I'm in this stage of that feeling. So my takeaways from the world are people are very powerful, and a conversation can change a lot, and that we should be far more grateful than we are.
And I think it, you know, what you've just said is you're deeply in what stage you are in now, and you know, there's no need for you to think of, you know, what's going to be, you know, the version of you once you have a child, because you have no idea until you're actually there. Is there this part of you that's kind of wanting to create more stability, you know, in a relationship? I mean, I don't even know what your relationship is, but, you know, relationship and kids, or right now are you exploring more human potential and boundaries?
I think at the moment it's all that's a good question. I'm in a bit of limbo, I suppose, because I'm waiting to restart this theatre tour and start sharing the journey again, and that will probably last for a year or so. But I definitely, you know, I'm 30 now. When I started the trip, I was 28. It feels very strange to have a couple of years over such a big chunk of my life. And then I'll definitely going to have a settling down phase, and I want that. I definitely want that. But I'm not in the mindset of hindering or reducing my ambitions, just to keep pushing forward. And I think it's interesting that we're speaking at this moment, because over the last couple of months of this lockdown, I've definitely been thinking more and more about what the next few years look like. And I mean, I've been planning, as you know, with any trips you have to do, you have to plan well in advance. And we've been in the progress of planning lots of great stuff. But I'm also looking ahead to once that's happened, once these next things that I want to do have happened, what happens then? And so who knows? It's like you said, I don't know. I'm living in the day.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you're also still processing. And I imagine it's an interesting process right now to write your book, because you're doing that, aren't you, currently?
Yeah. I've literally finished the first full draft a couple of days ago, and I'm now just going through making some amendments from the editors. So the book is, that journey of writing the book, it's been amazing, because it's stressful because of the deadlines. But other than that, I've really enjoyed the process of kind of, you know, spouting out all of these different tales of, and I've forgotten so many of them. You know, there's countries in there. If you asked me to name every country in the world, I'd probably get about 10% because honestly, there's so many that I forget where I came.
Are you was it hard to sit down for that amount of time to write?
yes. So I've been, my writing process, some people take themselves away and do a couple of hours a day and then get back to normal life, but I've just been doing solidly 12 hours a day and trying to do, you know, I don't think
an ultra. An ultra.
I'm about to say that. Try and do an ultra of the book writing world and just, you know, up at five in the morning and then just write all the way through till the evening, which I finished a couple of days ago, and I've had 24 hours of no more writing until I'm going to pick up the book again and start making some edits. But yeah, it's very difficult to sit still, Sam. You know that. I'm still out running a lot. I did, was it yesterday or the day before yesterday, I went out and did a double marathon, just a nice 84-kilometer jog, just to free my mind from the book.
Oh my God. Well, it is. This is your life. You live life on the move. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people have said to me before, like, oh, aren't you putting a pause on life? And I'm like, no, I'm living. Like, when I'm moving, like, I'm thinking deeper than I think when I'm in stationary mode, and okay, I'm connecting, you know, but it's all a choice. Like, we can live in different states, and maybe how I, you know, the state that you live in right now, which is very moving and, you know, potentially transient when borders open up, but it doesn't say that in 2 years' time you're going to completely change that state, and that's fine as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, it is a bit of a strange time, and you said it right there with this weird moment we're in. Nobody's been in this position before. I certainly wasn't expecting to be in this moment where the whole world is closing borders and all that sort of stuff. And like we said at the very beginning, of having articles about not going to places. And so I don't know, but I do know that the next year at least is going to be lots of good running experiences, making some more time for some friends, and taking a lot of time to say thank you to a lot of people, and doing some mini trips, to mini adventures, I suppose, as training for future events, but also just take some more time for myself, and share the journey and enjoy sharing the journey like we're chatting now.
Yeah, well, you certainly deserve it. And I kind of see this as your 197th marathon, you know, the calibration and reflection, and it's probably the biggest one that you'll ever do, because, like, you have earned this. You've earned this time.
I think so. Well, who knows? Well, you never know. We may end up we may end up doing an expedition together one day. Who knows?
I hope that we get to be physically in the same space. And until then, I cannot wait to get my hands on your book. And please, like, let me know when it comes out, because I'm going to read it. I'm going to do a review on it. And I feel like more people will learn so much from what you have to share, because your insights are second to none, and you're a beautiful storyteller, and I'm very excited to see what's the next phase for you.
Thank you so much. I really, really, really enjoyed chatting with you, and I'm looking forward to seeing what other bits and pieces you have on in the future as well. I realize you have parenthood as well, which is a whole different journey. So I'm really good for this. Thanks so much, Dan.
Thanks so much.
Wow. Nick is a remarkable, I guess we can call him, young man. I mean, at the age of 30, he's still very much at the beginning of his journey. There are a lot of runners who are listening to this podcast, no doubt, and I'm sure it's encouraging all of you to lace up the shoes and go for a run. But I would also say it is relevant to anyone. What this podcast for me describes is the idea of go out and do what you believe in. Don't wait for something tragic to happen in your life to create the things and make them into a reality. I found it incredibly powerful to hear the challenge, but also to hear how Nick frames his mind to almost be like a bulldog when he gets to that start line, which is like the resolution that he needs to push through like the insurmountable hurdles that he faced. Anyway, you can find Nick Butter through all of the channels that I'll list in the show notes. I hope you enjoy, and I hope you are safe, healthy, and well wherever you are right now. Lots of love from me to you, all the way from the Dandenong Ranges.